Hello and welcome to the Mezlis Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mezlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. How much responsibility does an authoritarian government have for creating conditions that lead its citizens to become militants and terrorists? Tajikistan is a country of strategic importance to many governments as it has a long, mountainous, and often porous border with Afghanistan. Many countries, including China, Russia, the U.S., and especially the other Central Asian states, do not want Islamic militants based in Afghanistan to cross into Tajikistan and spark instability that could spread through the region. Tajik President Emomali Rahmon's government has become too important to fail and received financial and security aid from a wide variety of countries for more than 30 years to ensure Tajikistan does not turn into a second Afghanistan or Syria. Rahmon has taken advantage of these concerns and this support to crush all potential opposition and allow his family to take control of nearly every profitable business in the country. Meanwhile, Tajikistan remains the poorest country in Central Asia, and 20% or more of the country's people have to travel abroad to find work. In recent months, a few dozen citizens of Tajikistan have carried out or are accused of carrying out or aiding in terrorist attacks in several countries, and the word Tajik is becoming associated with the word terrorist. The fallout from these attacks has been devastating for millions of peaceful Tajiks living outside Tajikistan. Should the Tajik government be blamed, at least in part, for creating this situation? In this program, we will take a close look at what life is like for Tajik citizens to try to understand why so many choose to leave home and why a few choose to join extremist groups. To discuss all this, I am joined by Marius Fossum, the regional representative in Central Asia for Norwegian Helsinki Committee, and Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer with many years of experience in Central Asia, who is currently an associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. Thank you both for joining me. Steve, let's start with some of the basics. Let's talk about education. What is the average Tajik citizen educated and to what level?
You know, it's difficult to do really credible on the ground sociological research really on any topic, because of the tight controls that the government places on independent researchers. We know that, you know, for at least a decade now, Western institutions have been really reluctant to approve people doing field work because of arrests and detentions. We remember the case of Alexander Sadikov years ago. So it's really difficult, I think, to do a solid study of the quality of the education. But as we were discussing offline, you know, education literacy rates nominally high. Certainly, people are school attendance is compulsory, and that occurs. But in general, what we know, and what we know anecdotally very well from many people that we talk to, is that corruption permeates every institution in Tajikistan, and it permeates schools in a gratuitous manner. You know, everyone knows that entrance exams can be, you know, preordained by your social station in Tajikistan. As you were just saying in the introduction, corruption is ever present. And I think it was in a preceding Majlis podcast, Salimjon Ayubzod, the director of the Tajik service, said very well that, you know, you take these exams and people that then don't show up for the next 4 years of their undergraduate education are able to get degrees, get jobs, whereas people that do go and maybe don't have the money to pay those bribes, you know, may not get placement. So education is there, but what sort of education? And then, you know, I think another thing we can say about the education system is that, like every other institution, it's dominated by the cult of personality, the absolute reverence for adulation of the authoritarian dictator, President Emomali Rahmon, who just, you know, presides over the entire society as a god. And I think it's to the point that I think it really perverts and degrades the quality of most state agencies, institutions that should be worrying about the quality of the services that they deliver, but instead, you know, have to cower in fear about not invoking the proper titles, you know, the architect of peace, defender of the nation. If you don't say those things, for example, when you write an article in the newspaper before the name President Emomali Rahmon, you can be jailed. So I think when you have that sort of a cult of personality, you have corruption, you have poverty. What you get about from the education system is not the same. Maybe certainly not what we used to know about, you know, 30 years ago when Tajikistan looked, let's say, a lot more like that late Soviet period was known for high levels of literacy. Even in places like Gorno-Badakhshan in Tajikistan, we're really known for high literacy rates. But I think, unfortunately, the government is doing everything it can to lower the quality of education.
Okay, thank you. Marius, I'm a Tajik citizen, we'll say. I'm the average Tajik citizen. I've completed my mandatory education, and maybe I've even gone to university. Once I get out, what are opportunities are there for me?
That's a very good question, because if you look at opportunities in Tajikistan, you're not going to be looking at a whole lot. Like, the unemployment rate is considerably higher than in Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, also higher than in Uzbekistan. It's expected to reach, I think, like 8% almost this year. So there's also a question, like, I agree with everything Steve just said, but there's also a question, like, why do you get an education when there is, like, no employment opportunities? And sadly, the unemployment rate, bad as it is, doesn't really give you the full picture of like how bad things are in Tajikistan. You mentioned it in your introduction that you have millions of Tajiks working abroad, mainly in Russia. Some estimate around 2 million Tajiks living in Russia. Some say at least 1 million Tajiks working in Russia at any given time. I saw some numbers from a couple of years ago that 3 million Tajiks had registered in Russia during that year. I also checked the World Bank latest available data from the World Bank before our call today, and they say that one-third approximately of GDP of Tajikistan comes from remittances from labor workers abroad. And also that 40% of Tajik households have at least one migrant worker living abroad. All that is to say that the political leadership in Tajikistan has failed to create any economy that could provide for its own population. And when millions of Tajiks go to Russia, where we know they face discrimination, xenophobia, and even more so now after a terror attack, and when they go there to do hard and low-paid labor, to work in construction, in cleaning, in agriculture and so on, they don't go there for fun. They go there because they cannot feed their families if they stay in Tajikistan, where there's just no jobs for you. I think people don't really realize how bad things are in Tajikistan. You have like a little under 30% of the population living on a little less than $2 per day. I could go on ranting about this, but maybe we stop for now.
Well, actually, this leads me to my next point is the economic situation for people who do live in Tajikistan. Let's forget about the remittances for a moment and just talk about the average Tajik citizen living and trying to live off his wage in Tajikistan. And I've seen various figures about what the average monthly wage is. In some cases, it's well under $100, and maybe if you're luckier, it's $120, $140. I mean, what kind of life can you live on the average, with the average wage in Tajikistan? And Marius, I'll start with you, but I'll get to you in your comments too, Steve.
You can certainly live in Tajikistan, but it's not a great life. Malnutrition is a big issue in Tajikistan, and also like growth impairment in children and food insecurity in certain areas. Malnutrition especially is important because nutritious food is just too expensive for people living on like a low paid wage. And that should give you an idea of just like how little you get for the average salary, even in like a Tajikistan market.
Okay, thanks. And Steve, your comments, and also taking into consideration, look at, even things like simple things we take for granted, like electricity, right? You can't get that all the time in Tajikistan. In fact, I think they're still under power rationing now, even though it's spring.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. There's I don't have all the economic data in front of me, and that's not my area of expertise, but certainly working in Tajikistan, traveling, being in the regions, one gets a sense immediately of, the you know, and I remember Marius and I have done this together. You walk down the streets of Dushanbe, the central streets, and you'll see a gleaming capital with beautiful, ostentatious monuments and buildings, really expensive hotels. But the second you leave pretty much that central boulevard, which is called Rudaki Boulevard, even in the city of Dushanbe itself, you'll enter into incredibly poor areas. As you said, Bruce, often gas shortages, electricity, lines at the gas station of cars, and just a lack of working services, a sense that you're cut off from the world. And it really has been, you know, unfortunately, that's no longer, can't be explained away by, you know, the civil war that happened 30 years ago. I'm sure we'll touch on that. This is, we're 30 years out from that experience. And yet Tajikistan is just governed this way, chronically mismanaged, and as we keep saying, corrupt, which I think, again, it degrades the quality of life in total. And so I certainly think that the desperation of life in the regions has been a huge driving factor, both of migration and as I think we'll get to, of radicalization, because that experience of being totally cut off, totally abandoned by your government in multiple ways, I think it compounds the sense of isolation, of desperation, especially for young men who have, as Marius was saying, this responsibility to feed the family, which you just can't live up to. And so your own Central Asian culture is put into conflict with the realities and the values of Central Asian culture, and your family and Islam are put in conflict with the conditions that the government is creating for you.
Thanks. You know, and every year it seems the Tajik government comes out and says, President Rahman himself, everyone should have 2 years' supply of food stored away in their house. I mean, how realistic is that? And what does that say to the population when the president is telling you should store up 2 years of food and your reality tells you that that's impossible?
Well, I'll just say again, not citing hard data, but I think malnutrition, it's a reality. It's visible. It's very clear. And there's been a number of humanitarian agencies working on this issue of just lack of access to food and malnutrition since the end of the Civil War. So it's been a longstanding issue. And again, this is one of the tragic results of shutting down, I think in the last year, 500 NGOs, is that you're shutting down a lot of these humanitarian agencies that have been working on these sorts of socioeconomic needs. So it's absolutely clear that, you know, maybe the word starvation is not what applies, but certainly chronic shortages of food. I remember when I was doing deep research into the problem of domestic violence, which is another huge factor and connected to radicalization, I met a lot of women who were essentially starving, who were, you know, abandoned by their husbands or had to leave, you know, situations of violence in the home or in the family, and were really living day to day. And there's been a number of excellent documentaries by some of the Tajik filmmakers about this issue. But I think, you know, your average person in Tajikistan outside of the corrupt elite really struggles to live, struggles to eat, struggles to work, struggles to pay for gas, struggles to really just get by.
So either one of you, is it realistic to think that the average Tajik citizen can store up 2 years of food?
Very shortly, no.
Okay, thank you. I know we have a lot of ground to cover, so I want to get on to the political situation in the country. What is the political situation in the country? What about opposition parties? Who's running the country? What does the parliament look like? Steve, I guess I'll start with you.
Well, Tajikistan is hardcore authoritarian and getting worse every day or every month. We've seen President Emomali Rahmon accrue power since 1992. When he first took over. And so we're talking about the post-Soviet region's longest serving autocrat. Up until what made Tajikistan different for some period of time up until 2015 was a very modest presence of pluralistic politics or competitive politics. And again, even very, very modestly, you had the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan with two seats out of 63 in the parliament up until 2015, which sounds like nothing, but was really significant, as we'll get to for a number of reasons, both political and religious. But that was all put to an end about a decade ago. And Rahmon really sort of decisively stated that there's going to be no pluralism. There will be no competitive politics. The opposition was hounded and repressed, with hundreds of people put in prison simply for exercising their peaceful civic rights. And really, since that time, we've been dealing with a different type of Tajikistan. Although it was repressive before, the last decade, as Marius and I have both often stated, is a human rights crisis, which just seems to see no end in sight. And so we know that censorship is total of the media. Opposition parties are not allowed to exist. Hundreds of NGOs shuttered. So we're dealing with a repressive system that really can't be overstated and has many, many, many different implications for, you know, both inside the country and transnationally, as we can get to.
Marius, is there any opposition parties functioning? Are there any opposition parties functioning in Tajikistan now?
There's no political opposition operating or functioning in Tajikistan now because the government has rooted them all out. They have outlawed opposition parties and movements and imprisoned en masse the opposition members. And you could say, like the Steve mentioned earlier, the Tajik civil war, which ended with a peace agreement in 1997. And like, if you want to simplify a little bit, you could say that after the peace agreement, the regime slowly have been continuing the war by other means, politics, and they have been settling scores with their old rivals ever since. Now they've taken care of, they've imprisoned and driven into exile the political opposition. Now they have been going after the informal leaders in Gordon Badakhsha. You can only ask who's going to be next, if anyone's left to be next. But in short, yes, there is no political opposition existing in Tajikistan because the government does not allow it. The Tajik regime is a one-man show centered around Emom Ali Rahmon.
That's right. I was just going to add to what Marius was saying, that just a day before we were recording this podcast, Freedom House came out with its figures on political rights. And they said that out of 40 political possible points for political rights, Tajikistan gets zero. So that, I think, says it all. Its score of freedom in the world has dropped even between 2023 and 2024. And that's due to this ongoing crackdown, sweeps of arrests of perceived critics. And that also includes, of course, peaceful religious Muslims.
And that's why, you know, I wanted to get to that point too. It's not just, and it was the registered political opposition groups, the Islamic Renaissance Party. There were others that came out of the civil war that they were after. But now it's expanded. It's a lot further than that, right? Even the potential support groups for opposition voices, lawyers, journalists, bloggers, right? I mean, they're all out on the target, on the hit list, so to speak, for the Tajik government.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the crackdown on civil society has been all-encompassing. And, you know, Marius mentioned the crackdown in the Pamirs in 2022. That included, for example, a colleague of ours named Manuchehr Holik Nazarov, who was a lawyer who headed the Pamiri Lawyers Association. It included Ulfat Khoni Mamadshoyeva, a journalist who was a grantee of USAID doing civil society work. And you know, I think particular to, I was thinking about just, you know, your question, Bruce, about the way repression ties into the question of radicalization. And in terms of some of the people that have been caught up in these absurd and farcical cases, I was thinking back to 2020 when the journalist Daler Sharipov, I know Marius knows this case too, was given a year imprisonment. He was a journalist, but he was actually imprisoned because he had authored a study or a booklet or a book that argued that Islam does not justify terrorism, that there's no justification for terrorism in Islam, right? Which would seem to be incredibly, you know, consistent with what the government says it wants to prevent. And he was given a year in prison for extremism. So we see these extremism cases take all sorts of ridiculous forms. But I think, you know, talk about shooting yourself in the foot, right? I think that's what the Tajik government seems to do really well when it comes to this question of extremism. So we see a lot of arrests, and many of them really directly, I think, inverted or contradicting the idea that you're trying to maintain peace and stability in this country.
Okay, thanks. And let's continue with religion. And Marius, I'll get to you with this. I mean, there was, you were mentioning Shripov case, but if we go back even further, you mentioned the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan as one. You know, they have their own interpretation of Islam and their own take on how it should be practiced and what it should mean in everyone's life, right? They, in the past, condemned the Taliban in the 1990s and said they were against the way, their form of Islam. They condemned the Islamic State. ISIS. Also, you would think that this would be a good thing for the government. And yet, if I was going to mosque now in Tajikistan, what am I likely to hear, Marius?
If you go to any mosque in Tajikistan for, say, Friday prayer, you're going to hear, if not written by the state, the sermon by the imam is going to be pre-approved by the state. And in some cases, and I don't know how often, but it happens that state organs send out pre-written manuscripts for Friday prayer. We know about a case where there was one imam who shared information about just this practice with Tajik exiled media in Europe. And as a thank you from the authorities, he was imprisoned for several years, I think, on charges of working with extremist groups. If I remember correctly.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think Marius is right. When I was meeting with the Committee on Religious Affairs several years ago in Tajikistan, they basically admitted that directly, that they prepare the sermons. You know, each week, imams are essentially, you know, representatives of the executive branch. They're all appointed by the state. They're monitored by the state. Everything they say has been vetted. And, you know, every aspect of religious life in Tajikistan, down to the clothes you can wear at the funeral of your own family members, is regulated. In the past several years, for example, they have banned women mothers from crying loudly at their children's funerals. They've been actually detaining people for wearing the color black, saying that is, you know, allegedly Salafi or Wahhabi. There are virtually no operating madrasas left in Tajikistan. There may be one or two officially, but, you know, in practice, there are no madrasas, no places you can go and actually study Islam properly. There are no Islamic bookstores. Bruce and I were talking about some of the contrasts with Uzbekistan, which has been experiencing somewhat of a revival or a renaissance in terms of the space for religious practice. Well, in Tajikistan, it really is the opposite. No bookstores. You know, we see all sorts of raids. I think I saw a figure cited by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom that there were 12,000 raids on various types of Islamic ceremonies in the home or in mosques just in the last year, in 2023. And of course, as Marius just said, we've seen a number of imams arrested and imprisoned for lengthy terms. So it goes, and I could go on and on as well, but the government keeps sending the message to peaceful Muslims in the country that we will control every aspect of your religious faith, whether you like it or not, from the way you dress to whether you wear a beard or a hijab. And we view you and we view Islam and we view religion suspiciously at its very core. As a sort of threat, an ever-present one.
Okay, thanks. And a reminder that we're talking about, should the, in this case, the Tajik government bear some responsibility for the radicalization of its own people due to the Tajik government's authoritarian policies? And joining me in this discussion are Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer with many years of experience in Central Asia, who's currently an associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California, and Marius Fossum, the regional representative in Central Asia for the Norwegian Helsinki Committee. Let's continue with that religion for just a second. And Marius, if I'm a practicing Muslim in Tajikistan and the imam, the mufti, can't answer the questions, the state-approved imam or mufti can't answer the questions I have about Islam, is there anyone I can openly turn to then at that point inside Tajikistan to get answers that I don't get from the people at my own mosque?
I see where you're going, but I'm not sure how to answer this question, actually. Maybe Steve could have a go.
Okay. Steve, who can I turn to?
Well, No, I'm thinking back again to, for example, a research trip that I took several years ago to a city called Istarafshan in northern Tajikistan. And I remember I met the father of a young man who had been imprisoned along with, I think it was about 50 other individuals at around 2008, 2009. This is a typical case. Because of, Bruce, as you just said, there's this demand for knowledge. There's no outlet for that. Islamic State educational institutions have been regulated extremely in every way. And so there's this natural pull and interest to seek out individuals in your community that may have more access to knowledge. And in that case, you know, years ago, there were more Tajiks that were studying in places like Egypt or Saudi Arabia or other parts of the Islamic world who would return to their communities, and sometimes they would seek to get jobs as imams and be turned away because of a corrupt muftiate that didn't see any space for them or even saw them as a threat. And so I think naturally you had these situations, and this is just the way communities work. People would informally get together and they would discuss religious topics in the home, right? Religion is a intensely personal or a family-based experience often. And so I would meet these people whose children had been imprisoned on charges of extremism simply for regularly getting together, or a few times, or maybe even just one time, meeting with someone who is deemed suspicious for having been outside the country studying Islam or coming back in. And you know, there were always these allegations of extremism without real evidence of any actions or any incitement to violence. And you know, often we see this in Central Asia, and it's not only a Tajik problem, is this conflation between ideology, which in some cases may be extremist or not or unsympathetic, and actually violent extremism, which is actually evidence of advocating violence or involvement in violence. And it's that boundary that's often blurred by the authoritarian powers in Tajikistan. So in Istarafshan, I remember these 50 or so young men were all arrested in mosque. They were tortured over days. Then they were put on trial. Then they were given lengthy terms. And, you know, we've had years and years of cycles of these sorts of arrests. We had a big trial end in 2021 of about 100 individuals that were accused of being part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this was linked back to actually a foreign national, an Egyptian that was teaching Arabic in one of the national universities in Tajikistan. And those meetings to discuss Islam were converted into so-called evidence of extremism. And so I think it is true that when you go and you seek that knowledge in some other part of society, you know, the IRPT is already gone. It's already been banned. Shia Islam under attack in the Pamirs. So these more informal meetings start to become incredibly dangerous for ordinary people in the country.
I'd just like to add to that that regarding those 101 persons imprisoned for allegedly membership in Muslim Brotherhood, that we saw no credible evidence that they were members in the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was probably an overeager security service wanting to appear productive and efficient in the year of the Tajik elections in 2020.
I think that's right. And I think Marius is absolutely right. And one of the interesting details about that case in particular was that one of the, I think the brother-in-law of Hoji Akbar Turajon Zoda and Nuruddin John Turan Zoda, who are highly respected Islamic figures in Tajikistan, was part of that case, was sentenced to 15 years. And that's really significant. These authority figures that from the Soviet time had derived legitimacy and had been seen among the population as popular as sources of Islamic knowledge, slowly but steadily, the Rahmon regime has discredited them, moved to delegitimize them. And I think that's all contributing to a sense of this vacuum when it comes to knowledge about Islam. And one other, you know, sort of older aspect of this that doesn't get mentioned as often these days, because it relates back to about more than a decade ago, is this law on parental responsibility, which basically bans anyone under the age of 18 from even going to mosque. And one should also mention that back in 2004, 2005, women were basically also banned from attending mosques. So you have whole segments of youth and an entire gender, right, not allowed to participate in Islam. And when you do get to the mosque, as we discussed, it's you know, Rahman is this, Rahman is a great leader. And all that, I think, warps the whole experience of religion, which is a fundamental right, and you know, has led to the UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Religion, who visited the country, to say that freedom of religion is alarmingly out of scope with international human rights guarantees.
So is it fair to say that economically, politically, spiritually, there is no alternatives in Tajikistan to the state?
The state is everywhere, and the state strives to control all aspects of life. Like someone, I don't remember if you or Steve mentioned Uzbekistan recently, and Tajikistan is growing ever more similar to Uzbekistan under Islam Karimov.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. I like that. And actually, Steve and I were discussing this recently. Okay, so a deteriorating education system, pitiful economic conditions, zero chance of voicing an alternative political view to the current governments. I'm forced to leave Tajikistan. Should anyone be surprised that some people have fallen in with bad associates, I'll say?
You know, this always gets delicate and sensitive. Bruce, as we were discussing, nobody wants to draw a causal relationship, and you know, talking about violent extremism and what drives people to it is a multifactorial or very multi-layered discussion and analysis. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I think an experience of being, abusive towards women has also been found to be, you know, often very relevant in this analysis to people that decide to engage in violence, and that's an issue in Tajikistan that, you know, I don't think we should ignore because it's ever present and it's really an epidemic. But I was just going to say, as you were mentioning this recently, Muhyiddin Kabiri, the exiled leader of the IRPT, actually put it very bluntly. He said it would be surprising, given everything that we were just discussing. He said it would be surprising if the youth of Tajikistan did not join ISIS. That's how he put it. Which I really found very, very striking.
No, one can understand that. I mean, Marius, let's face it. You know, the situation we've been describing in Tajikistan, you're kind of a non-entity practically. You're there purely to serve the state. Now, if you go online and someone says there's a chance to make something out of your life, to be someone important, to do something important, you know, it seems like that the Imam Ali Rahman's Tajikistan has set up a lot of its citizens to fall prey to this.
Yeah, I'm also no expert on radicalization and what make people come carry out terrorist attacks. And you see terrorists and radicals emerge also in richer and democratic countries. But like the political leadership in Tajikistan, with everything we've been talking about now, the brutal political oppression, suppression of freedoms, including freedom of religion and any other freedom you can think of, corruption, kleptocracy, an underdeveloped, underperforming, underachieving state-dominated economy based on like probably Soviet-era agriculture, export of metals, and what have you. What more do you have? Remittances from migrants. With all that and an economy unable to provide for the population, and millions see no hope at home and they are forced to go to Russia, where life is also not very sweet for Tajik migrant workers, then yes, you could say that a political leadership in Tajikistan has created some conditions in which extremist recruiters have an easier job.
That's right. I think Marius is right to say that it's a complicated inquiry, and I agree with his statement just now. But I am remembering, Bruce, you mentioned this on a previous podcast, Gulmurod Khalimov, right? The most famous Tajik ISIS fighter. He wasn't exactly, you know, hurting for resources. That was an opportunistic choice. He had been, I think he had been a lieutenant colonel and a commander of the police special forces in the Interior Ministry of Tajikistan until 2015. And as you noted, Bruce, I think some weeks ago, when he joined ISIS, he said that the banning of the IRPT or the repression of Islam in general had led him to make that decision. But it was clear that that choice was opportunistic. Perhaps it was economic. Perhaps it was glory. There were things that contributed to that. But I agree with the statement that, you know, we do have to be very careful when we make these connections. But those general conditions of repression, undoubtedly, they create fertile ground for ISIS and other extremist groups to recruit Tajiks.
No, I agree. There is no one, there is no paradigm model that we can say that this is what produces a terrorist. There's no doubt about it. But I did want to get to the points that the socioeconomic conditions in Tajikistan certainly do not help dissuade people from moving toward radicalization. You know, in some ways, I kind of echo Kabiri's comments, and I'll put it differently, that perhaps it's not so surprising that a few Tajiks have joined these groups, but it's surprising that more have not joined these groups. But let's go to the support base for Rahman's government. I've had you both on the program before, and there's been times where we've said governments need to take a harder stance with Tajik authorities for their corruption, mismanagement, misgovernance, whatever you want to call it, in the country. But given that we've now seen Tajik citizens held accountable for terrorist attacks, should governments, some of these governments, any particular governments you want to name, change their policy toward Tajikistan to show them exactly what we've been talking about, that what you're doing is actually leading people into these groups and you need to change the policies? What do you think about that idea? Marius, I'll start with you.
I will say the same that I've said numerous times before, and I think on your podcast as well, that the time is long, long, long overdue for Tajikistan's democratic partners to get serious and hold the authorities in Tajikistan accountable and to implement at least targeted sanctions against key gross human rights violators. And it wouldn't be difficult. The candidates are there. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
That's fine. And Steve, I mean, even China and Russia, right? Especially Russia, with what recently happened. Isn't it in their interest too to tell Rahman you have to do something to give your people some hope, because you're just making them easy targets for recruitment for these extremist groups.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought the question to the wrong responses first, and I think we'll get back to what Marius was saying in a moment. But certainly, Putin is not the messenger to be telling Rahman to give his people hope. He of course is leading Russia down the most repressive path it's seen in over 30 years. And the relationship, I thought it was very interesting, you know, you had Salim John from Ozodi on, he was talking about the vicissitudes of this relationship. I mean, Rahman has been in and out of favor with Putin at various times, and there's often been threats of expelling Tajik migrants, which would, you know, collapse the Tajik economy. But what I've been monitoring more recently, when it comes to Russia's response, is, you know, you've seen there's xenophobia has always been a problem within Russian society towards Tajiks, and it leads to the sense of isolation, the desperation that Tajiks face in the country. But since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we've seen this just blossoming further of Telegram channels that sort of, both in their ire directed at Ukraine, they've really been using Central Asians as another outlet. And I've been seeing just a dramatic rise in, and Marius is probably watching this in relation to Kazakhs, where he's based. We see that, Kazakhstan is an object of scorn often from the pro-military nationalist bloggers, but Tajiks are certainly getting it now in droves. And so I'll often see these messages coming from various Russian bloggers that talk about, you know, Moskabad Vilayet or Omsk Vilayet, using, you know, the designations of a region using that we often see in Muslim countries to sort of describe the proliferation of Tajik migrants or women wearing the hijab on the streets of Russia. And sort of talking about how Tajiks are converting Russia into a Muslim country, and it's really xenophobic and it's nasty. But one thing that we see is that you know, Russia is both through its migration policies, it's repressing Tajiks. We'll talk about, you know, what Turkey is doing with visas and scrapping visa-free travel for Tajiks in a moment. But I think Russia is certainly compounding the problem. It's compounding the problem of Tajikistan by cracking down on migrants, and it really just sort of full-scale engaging in this xenophobia. And you mentioned China. I would say that, you know, on the state-to-state level, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it simply reinforces with Tajikistan this approach to extremism, which is heavy-handed, which is to basically outlaw and control everything, censor the internet. We see that coming from – that message coming from Beijing. So these are all the wrong responses. I think we could start with that. That, you know, I think trapping Tajiks in their own country by scrapping visas in Turkey, that's going to lead to a whole host of problems, compounding the xenophobia in Russia, and then securitizing the issue in China, or is or in Chinese Tajikistan relations, is a bad idea.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the show, but I want to give you both a chance to make some last comments. And particularly, you know, for the audience, anyone in the audience who's not familiar with the Tajik people, and of course, we've all been there and we know them well. Can you speak a little bit about why is it wrong to consider Tajiks terrorists? I mean, why are they getting a bad deal with this? And what should people know about the Tajik people, the Tajik people that you've met, that you spent time with? Marius, I'll start with you.
It's wrong to consider Tajiks to be terrorists because of a very, very small group of Tajiks who, it appears, committed a terrorist attack in Moscow recently. I say appears because we don't really know who did it, but it appears that, according to some footage I saw from Medusa, I think that the perpetrators were the ones who were actually captured by Russian authorities later. But this is a tiny, 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 tiny percentage of the Tajik population. And those of us who know Tajiks know they are lovely people. And the Tajiks I know are highly intelligent, and they're all dreaming of a bright future for Tajikistan, where Tajikistan is a democratic country, where its people can finally make a living at home and millions do not have to go abroad to basically slave in the migrant labor economy in places where, like Russia and elsewhere.
Okay, thank you. And I think at this point I need to mention too that, of course, Rahman, President Rahman, is grooming his son to be a successor. So this is another problem with the situation in Tajikistan. Is not only is it bad right now, but that it's possible that it might be the same way for the next 30 or 40 years. But Steve, I want to get your comments too on this.
Yeah. Well, I want to first just pick up on the last set of recommendations Marius was making earlier and say I totally agree that the time is now. We've been talking about repression in all its various forms. The time is absolutely right now to go to the sources of that repression, the perpetrators of that repression, and put them on the global Magnitsky list and on the list of sanctioned individuals for transnational repression. And I think I would start with the head of the security services in Tajikistan, Mr. Yatimov. I'd look very closely at Rahmon's whole set of advisors. But I think that's long been, I think, a goal of the human rights community, is to actually start doing what you've been talking about at the beginning, Bruce, which is accountability for the repression. So we need to do that. I think number two on my list of policy changes in terms of the right responses, well, since 2012, the U.S. Commission on Religious Freedom has been calling Tajikistan a country of particular concern. And even since 2016, the State Department added, joined that assessment. And yet the White House keeps giving Tajikistan a waiver from those sanctions on national security grounds. Now, the U.S. is now out of Afghanistan. There's less of a justification to be working with this government when it is engaging in this repression. So I really hope that we're going to see a shift, and Crocus City is as good a justification as any other to wake up and start dealing with this government in the manner that it has earned in terms of the repression. I think the European Union has to look really hard at whether it wants to give trade benefits and privileges in the form of what we call GSP, the Generalized System of Preferences. And so beyond those responses, which I think, you know, and of course, we haven't delved too much into the Pamiri crisis and everything that entails. But I think Marius is absolutely right. The Tajiks I know that I work with are people I admire for, you know, their ability to struggle amidst the repression to build a country that they want to see, a democracy, a pluralistic country. Tajik culture is amazing. I mean, that's one thing that gets lost in all these discussions about radicalization is just, you know, the arts, the music, the history, the culture. There's so much to be discovered that's rich. And I think that unfortunately just gets drowned out by this cult of personality. And so therefore, I think we really need to study Tajikistan. We need to support civil society. And just like is happening with Russia amidst this crackdown where, you know, civil society is being crushed over these last few years, I think what we're going to hopefully have to do is have organizations that are able to support Tajik NGOs, civil society, and the democratic movement, even though that one that is abroad, from outside in more creative ways, through media support, through support for human rights reporting, through more research on religion, maybe, as we've been discussing, more sources of proper Islamic education. There's a lot of things that can be done. And of course, supporting women and persons with disabilities and LGBT groups in Tajikistan. So all that has to continue, especially if we want to, you know, cut off the sources of, I think that, you know, of radicalization, as we've been discussing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Did anyone want to make any last comments, something I missed?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that what Steve said was wonderful. And after the Crocus attack, we have received reports from some Tajiks based in Europe. I'm not necessarily going to name and shame any European countries now, but some of them are getting in trouble in Tajikistan and in Europe. And we're talking about peaceful Tajik opposition activists who, it appears, may face deportation from Europe now as we're speaking, as a direct result of the Crocus attack, which is an extremely worrying development.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And also just to repeat what Steve said a while ago, that unfortunately, Turkey decided it would cancel the visa-free regime for Tajik citizens earlier this month. You know, this is the knee-jerk reaction, but it's unfortunate that a whole people are suffering for the actions of a very few. And even then, like I said, I think the Tajik government in this case deserves to be blamed for a lot of the conditions that have led to what's going on right now. So thank you both for being on the program. I will come back to this topic again probably pretty soon. But I appreciate you being on the show. So thank you, Marius and Steve. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio for Europe, Radio to Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.